This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Mark Gordon. He's writer, director, and producer of the film Awakening in Taos, the Mabel Dodge Lujan story. And we're joined also by Leslie Harold Dillon, who is the voice of Mabel Dodge Lujan in the film, and Nancy Kenny, who is the music composer and supervisor, as well as associate producer. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
So this film is actually opening this Wednesday, November 18th at the Lensic at 7 o'clock. It's a world premiere, but ladies and gentlemen, before you get too excited, it's totally sold out.
It's completely sold out. 791 of our closest friends will be there.
Most excellent. Well, it's nice after the years that you've been working on this, and you've been working on this film for a long time.
It was conceived about 10 years ago. The most, and we would work on it off and on over the years. But about 3 years ago, I moved here from California so we could just focus on getting it done. And it's a totally independent film with a partnership with PBS New Mexico. And we've raised all of the funds for it through private donations, charitable donations from individuals to our nonprofit arts foundation, and sponsorships, and a few major grants.
So how did you get the idea in the first place to do a movie about Mabel Dodge Lujan?
Well, originally I started a film company in Santa Fe in 1977, but it was a little early, so I went back to California for many years. And about 10 years ago, I was noticing that they were making a lot of films in New Mexico, but it was all Wyoming, Montana, the Wild West,
Longmire,
with and without aliens. And I thought, why isn't anyone making a film in New Mexico about the people who lived here, the art, the culture, the architecture, and have that be part of the story? And a docent at the Fashion Museum introduced me to Mabel Dodge Lujan's book, The Edge of Taos Desert, An Escape to Reality. And I just fell in love with the story because, it's 1917. She leaves Greenwich Village and winds up at the Santa Fe Plaza, with burros and wood carts, and it just was a fantastic story, and I fell in love with it, and I thought, well, to make a great feature film, maybe we'll do this little documentary film so we can research Mabel. And 10 years later, the research is now done.
Right. So it's a lot. I mean, congratulations on finishing this.
Thank you.
It's been a long time in the making.
It's been a long time in the making. Half of our time has been spent raising the funds to do it. We hopefully the next one will go a little bit faster. But we're very excited. We've had a lot of support and interest, and so many people have heard about it that the Lensic Theater is filled.
Excellent. So we'll talk about Mabel, and actually I wanted to turn to you, Leslie Harold Dillon. When I first moved to Santa Fe over 20 years ago now, you were doing a one-woman show on Mabel Dodge Lujan.
Right.
Which you did a version of recently, another one-woman show.
Right, and it added in the new material that had become available from the Beinecke Library in the year 2000, and then Lois Rudnick, her biographer, put it into a new book around syphilis issues and the affair she had with the doctor after she had her baby. So I added that material into the show. And interestingly, for a weekend, I came back to Santa Fe in 2006. I was living in Boston and getting my master's at BU. But I came back and did a weekend where I alternated between my Mabel Dodge Lujan show and my Me and George show, which is an autobiographical show about my time on The Perfect Storm. Anyway, so Mark, that was when I first met Mark, mm-hmm. in 2006. And he came to one of the evenings of the Mabel show, and he was so enthusiastic, and he had flowers, and it was very sweet. And I didn't know him, and that's when our relationship began.
And
Mabel.
And we did an initial interview, and we have been meeting regularly ever since for coffee to discuss, you know, how would you handle this and what happened there. And it's been really wonderful. I think Lois Rudnick actually introduced us to each
That's
other.
Right.
So I knew a little bit about you before that.
Right. So let's talk about this character. I mean, we've talked about her before, but she just keeps coming up because she's such a fascinating and sort of multifaceted figure. She was very much of a kind of woman ahead of her time in
yes.
a lot of ways. She just did not want to be constrained by Victorian ideas of womanhood. She wanted to do whatever she wanted, and she was married so many. Let me see if I got her names right. If you were to say all of her single and married names, she would be.
I can do it.
Tell me if this is right. Mabel Ganson Evans Dodge Stern Lujan. Yes.
I think that about covers it.
So those were.
Yeah, she was married four times. The fourth marriage lasted for 40 years. So. She finally arrived at the right place, and she married a very unlikely person, Antonio Lujan, who was a full-blooded Tiwa Indian from Taos Pueblo, and it was probably the first time that anyone had married outside of a tribe. So it was very, very, it was, I think, more difficult for him than it was for her, because she was in these kind of liberal, progressive groups of people that were more accepting, but Taos Pueblo couldn't figure out what the heck Tony was doing, and it took many years before they eventually accepted it, and the cacique blessed their marriage.
But it took a long time.
And they were both married to other people when they met each other.
Right. And, I mean, not only was she not a member of the tribe, but she was really a controversial figure within Taos.
She became so.
Yeah.
She became so. You know, there was like a love-hate relationship with her. Udre Myers, the artist who his father was very close with her, said that people either loved her or hated her, and his theory was that if you were inside her in-group, you loved her, and if you couldn't get into that group, you hated her.
She was also a very wealthy lady. She spent a lot of money during her life. She brought people together. She was a writer. And she was a person who I think was really, and maybe you can, as somebody who's really kind of lived inside her as an actress, Leslie, tell us more about her. But she was somebody who really was trying to navigate female power in
right.
this world in its multiform and myriad manifestations.
Right, and she was a searcher. She was always trying to find not only for herself, but how does this jive with what's happening around culturally. You know, that was one of her inspirations in having both the salon in Florence, but then more intensely in New York. And she gathered these people together to find out sort of what the cultural and political pulse was. And even though she didn't often talk a lot at these salons, it was really to gather people, to have them exchange ideas. And so she was very progressive in that way. So it wasn't just her ego trying to insert itself onto a situation, but she wanted to gather the situation together and say, all right, where can I make a contribution into this? What's happening? How do we get the word out about this? And that was what, of course, was so powerful in her collaboration with John Reed when they made the Patterson Strike pageant, which was the first of its kind in Madison Square Garden. And here was a chance to give and to enlighten and you know, inspire a movement in New York to support the strikers who had been murdered in Patterson.
Yeah, what was that pageant all about?
So there was a silk factory in New Jersey, in Patterson, New Jersey, that was underpaying their workers, and so they decided to strike. Well, what ended up happening was there was police brutality. A couple of the strikers were actually murdered. And none of the newspapers in New York, none of the newspapers would touch the story. So they decided to organize the strikers themselves to put on a pageant where they acted out the murder and the strike, and 15,000 people showed up for that, and it was hugely successful. Unfortunately, the mill could not sell the products if they gave them a raise, and so it was not successful. But it taught Mabel how to use the media to make changes. And years later, she used what she learned from that experience to help defeat a federal bill that would have taken away 600,000 acres of tribal lands in New Mexico that were deeded from Spain in the 1500s.
Mm-hmm. And that was such an interesting and such an important moment. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that. I mean, basically, they were just going to take tribal land and sell it to the highest bidder.
Well, they were trying to figure out a way to resolve the issues of squatters and people who had Hispanics who had maybe married someone in the tribe, and they were living on the land. But it was very thinly veiled. It was just really a way that they could get legislation passed so that they could purchase Indian land, non-native Indians and squatters could get clear title to native land. And Mabel got very involved in supporting the efforts of the tribe, and Tony and John Collier, who later became the director of the Indian Bureau of Indian Affairs. They went around to all the tribes to explain to them what was happening and what the threat was. And Mabel's biggest contribution to that was that the women had just gotten the right to vote. There were 5 million women in the Federated Women's Clubs of America, and she mobilized them to deluge their congressmen with letters. And the congressmen were afraid that if women were angry at them and they didn't listen, that they would be voted out of office in a block, that women would just go, get rid of all these guys. It's never happened, but the fear of it helped prevent this legislation that would have been tragic for the Native Americans in New Mexico.
We're talking about the film Awakening in Taos, the Mabel Dodge Lujan story, and the majority of the film is the New Mexico part of it. Is that right, or about half of it?
We had to explain where she came from so people could really understand who she was and what she did. And, a part of it that's really important is that she met Gertrude Stein in Paris and was introduced to Picasso and Matisse and all of the modernist artists. And so that she was so inspired by Gertrude Stein's salons that she wanted to bring that to the U.S., and she did so in Greenwich Village in 1913.
That whole period in the early 20th century when, Picasso and Braque were inventing cubism and modernism was emerging, and this famous art show called the Armory Show brought a lot of that stuff to the United States for the first time. But the transition and that the sense of social change from the kind of mild Victorian womanhood that Mabel Dodge was born into, and then the sense of possibility that this kind of art and culture and kind of social opening and liberation made possible. It's, you sort of have to almost imagine yourself into that time to really understand how huge it was, but that's really what she went through.
And in a sense, that's what we do, is we paint the picture for what it was like for Mabel growing up in a Victorian family. She came from a very wealthy family, but there was no love and warmth, and she always felt that there was something missing, and, she was not trained to do anything other than be a wife and mother. And this was not satisfying to her, and she began to find kindred spirits in Europe, in France, in Florence, and then later in Greenwich Village, where feminism that was really being acted out and thought out. And the opening quote for the film is, "I wanted to live in a world where a woman could choose her own path in life." And I'm sure young women today think, "Well, of course, I'm going to do that. That's my right." But I don't think they realize how hard women had to fight to get what they have today. And a number of women have been supporters of our project because they want their daughters to hear the story, to see the story.
Very, very interesting. Nancy Kenny, how did you get involved in the film?
I was initially part of this film because I went to What the Bleep, and sitting right next to me, I was by myself. Rarely do I go to movies by myself, but sitting next to me by herself was Jill Drinkwater, who is also one of our producers. And I offered her some popcorn, and we both sat there, and we watched What the Bleep, and then we went for tea. And we started talking about Mabel Dodge. And I said, oh, my gosh. I said, my friend Mark Gordon, he's really interested in doing something about Mabel Dodge in a documentary form. And so was my sister Katie Peters and Tom McCarthy from the Museum of New Mexico. And so we all got together, had a big round table, and there was about, you know, seven or eight of us who were all very excited about that. And that was like 10 years ago, and we were saying, okay, who wants to do the feature? Who wants to do the documentary? And we just started brainstorming. And then Katie and Tom McCarthy had already done some interviews, and Mark was all geared up. And so that's how it began for me. And I was sort of at the connector, to use the tipping point, you know, term. And Mark, certainly the maven, and Leslie, the mavens. But I got a lot of people together on it, and I've just been very, very supportive of it the whole time. But I think the thing that most amazes me about Mabel, we're talking born in 1879. We're talking 1915 coming to New Mexico. You know, I mean, think about that. Way back then, my dad wasn't even born. And she created for herself a dynamic where she discovered who she was inside. That's, I think, the main thing. It's like, yes, she was, you know, incredibly important to the world around her and in that movement, the progressive movement and the modernist movement. But for her personal evolution and her transformation, she had to face the fact that she was looking externally for who she was. And that really meant a lot to me, because I think all of us, even at late stages of life, can figure out who we are and begin to express that. And that's what she did with her writings. And
that's what was so important. I think that you ask, why do we care about her now? Well, exactly that, because women are always searching for inspiration on how do I get through today? Who am I at these different stages in life, like you're saying? And that was what was so important about her memoirs, because she was upfront with it. Here was what I was like when I was young, you know, and she let it out that she wasn't making the right choices. But those four memoirs really show an arc of her searching, and are such an inspiration. And I think, you know, are sort of the beginning of the whole memoir thing that we've been experiencing. Uh-huh. But I think that her story and the way she did search, like you say, is still an inspiration today, no matter what age you are, for a woman.
Or for a man, too. Really.
Well, yeah.
I mean, all of us have that desire to create the deeper purpose. And I, as the composer, I've been doing a lot of things in the last 20 years, raising a child and working in my husband's business and then starting my own online education business in architecture and all these other things. But I was a composer. I was born to do music, and I went to school to do music. And when I got the chance to do the music for this, I said, now I'm going to do the Mabel story thing. You know, I'm going to do what I do.
She's done a beautiful job. She's really given the heart and soul to the film, because it's the emotional undertone through the music.
Yeah. Yeah, and music in a documentary, sometimes you don't focus on it until you watch it for the second time, because it kind of like carries the story, but you're focused on the visuals and the story itself. But it's not all, it's your music, and it's also some New Mexican music and things like that that you've brought into it.
That's right. In fact, I had to go outside of, well, I decided initially to look at the Taos Pueblo and see what kind of music was happening there. Well, of course, there's Robert Mirabal's music, which most people have heard about. But, well, some of the greatest music that we have going as well is a Blue Spruce Standing Deer, who is a great grandson
of Tony Lujan, mm-hmm. is one of the major contributors to the film as a musician, singer, and we've interviewed him in the film, and he's really given us Tony's character. He even He even reads Tony Lujan's lines in Tiwa with English subtitles so that people can respect the intelligence of this man.
And over time, we have had so many fundraisers, and he basically sets the tone. He sings beautifully at the beginning of almost all of our fundraisers, and thank you, by the way, fundraisers out there. But really, Standing Deer has been fantastic as the heart and soul and the rhythm and the beat. And
It's like we have Tony Lujan's spirit and voice with us and he'll be performing, he'll be singing and drumming to introduce the film on Wednesday night.
And then we went to Jack Loeffler, because Jack Loeffler has recorded over 3,000 recordings of Hispano Indio music of the northern New Mexico. And he basically said, take a look. What do you want? What do you need? And he just opened his archives to us. And we had a lot of fun listening to some of these things by Cipriano Vigil. And it's just been a fabulous experience.
And Jack said, I have all this music. I've recorded it all. I own all the rights to it, Mark. I just want it to be heard. And it gives this authentic, when we get to New Mexico and to Taos, we have this authentic music that is probably what would have been heard in New Mexico at the time.
Yeah. So it's been a very interesting blend. And interestingly enough, Robert Mirabal's music was primarily used for the rhythmic and sort of the magical aspects of the underscore.
We're very grateful to Robert for licensing us some of his wonderful music.
The film is Awakening in Taos, the Mabel Dodge Lujan story. And I think the relationship with Tony Lujan is such an interesting one, and I sometimes feel almost like voyeuristic trying to figure it out because it was really her business, and everybody has their opinion about it. But since she's a public figure and people write books and make documentaries about her, this was a man. He was an Indian from Taos Pueblo. She saw him in a dream or something like that, or in a vision before she
came to New Mexico. She had a dream one night where she saw her third husband's face, and it disappeared and was replaced by this dark Indian face that was like a medicine to her. And she woke up going, what was that? And then she decided, I have to go to New Mexico. I'm going to go to Santa Fe, where Maurice had gone for their wedding. She had sent him alone on their honeymoon, I meant to say, to paint the Indians. And so she ended up coming out here, and that's what drew her to the area.
And then she actually saw this man who became her husband, saw his face. She was still married to Maurice Stern. Tony Lujan was married to
Candelaria. She 2 weeks after she gets to Taos, she's just drawn there. She doesn't know why. Her third husband does not want to go, but he kind of comes along grudgingly. And she's walking through the pueblo, and she hears this drumming and singing, and she's like drawn to this doorway. And the woman of the house gestures to her to come in, and she sits down. And there's an Indian man playing the drum and singing with his back to her. And she just becomes, you know, involved with the feeling of it. And when he finishes, he turns around, and it's the man that she dreamed about. It's Tony Lujan. And he had dreamt about her, too.
Yeah. And they did seem to have, well, a very long-term, I mean, decades-long relationship.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't always easy.
What was it like? What was that relationship like?
Well,
you first, then me.
I mean, that huge, huge cultural divide between them.
Right, right. And I think that there is a kind of soul, a meeting of a soul there, that she felt there was always mystery, which Tony would not solve or answer for her. And I think that kind of frisson of mystery and soul kept them, for both of them, kept it alive through all the difficulties. And I think that it's interesting that Mabel stuck with it. And I, you know, bless Tony for sticking it through with her, because oftentimes they would come just be in such different worlds and so difficult. But I just think that there it speaks to the possibilities of love beyond race, beyond language, that people, you just feel it. You know, it's just there.
Mabel said that she could always hear Tony's thoughts, that somehow that their hearts spoke to each other, and his great-grandson attests to the intimacy that the two of them had. And when you hear this ancient language of Tiwa spoken in the film, then you're even more baffled, because he did not speak a lot of English. When Mabel writes about him, it sounds like Tonto. And we didn't want to offend anyone, so we had him speak in his native tongue and translate that into English. And then you think, how did they spend 40 years together?
Yeah.
Just by the language. But they had some really deep connection. He was not interested, although he benefited from her wealth and her power. He wasn't looking for that. He just, his heart found something in her heart that was a soul connection, and it was worth it for him to sacrifice everything.
And he did sacrifice basically his entire community.
Yes, he had his family at the Pueblo, and he would spend time with them. He left his wife, and Mabel actually paid spousal support to her because there was such a battle going on. She supported her for the rest of her life. And the Pueblo still has hard feelings about it.
Do they really?
Yeah.
Did you notice that as a filmmaker?
Well, I talked to many people at the Pueblo. Many of the women are just, well, we don't want to glamorize Mabel Dodge Lujan. She was a home wrecker.
Yeah.
And, it's interesting. It's 100 years later, and they're still angry about it.
It's just, I guess it's a little hard to understand because, I mean, 40 years without having too many real conversations in English when you don't share a language, like what did they do all day?
Oh.
Well, he was a rancher. He was busy. He was building houses. He was before Mabel came, he was kind of like the Indian who the Anglos would ask to help build their house or repair their houses. But they had a way of talking and communicating that was just a basic understanding. And they did speak. I think she picked up a little Tiwa. He picked up a little English.
And he left writings behind, which is what you are...
No, he did not write.
He dictated some letters,
He dictated letters to Georgia O'Keeffe.
I mean, the things that you're quoting in the film that are read in Tiwa language.
Actually, those are lines that we developed with the great-grandson who, we had some appropriate answers based on some of the writings, some of Mabel's memoirs, and he translated them into Tiwa, and he said, but then he said to us, he said, it's different than what you've asked me to translate because we speak differently. So I said, well, translate to me in English what you said in Tiwa, and it was better than what we'd written, so we kept it.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Now, another character who Mabel Dodge Lujan was kind of obsessed with was D.H. Lawrence. Why the great obsession with him in particular? I mean, she brought him to New Mexico.
Well, Mabel was profoundly moved in New Mexico. It changed her life. And prior to this, she felt that a woman couldn't be a writer, that a woman had to be a muse to artists and writers. So she read The Sea in Sardinia, which was a travelogue that D.H. Lawrence had written, and she thought, wow, this is the one writer who could really tell my story of Taos. And so she had an ulterior motive. She had a book that she wanted written, and she brought D.H. Lawrence to New Mexico. Well, his wife was not comfortable with him being alone in a room with that woman. And
can you blame her?
And they ended up not writing the book, but they wrote an outline. And that outline is almost exactly the outline for the book Edge of Taos Desert, which Mabel later wrote. Part of it was she was so frustrated that she couldn't get D.H. Lawrence to write this book that she, and he said, write it yourself.
Right, right.
And she wrote 1,600 pages of memoirs.
Well, that whole question of memoir, and I want to ask all of you this, how do they hold up over time?
Well, I love her writing. I mean, Edge of Taos Desert is my favorite book because I think that's her best writing voice. But she was a thinker. She had a way of observing people. She could explain in a very few words who a person was, what his attitude was, what he looked like, and where he fit in the social scheme of the universe. And I find it very fascinating. I've read her books many times, and every time I read it, I always find something that I hadn't noticed before. She was very, very wise and observant, and she had great comments that were very poetic about life.
Well, what I liked very much was that she says in an essay or an article that I read, but that she wanted, in the four different memoirs, were different stages in her life, and she wanted to reflect the voice, her inner voice of that time. So she really made an effort as a writer. It's sort of like I try to do in my solo pieces, the autobiographical ones, is to let the voice reflect what I was going through at that particular time. And I really appreciated that as both a writer and an actor, that she changed rhythms, she changed her vocabulary and her way of talking about things. She really wanted, and sometimes she was more successful than others, but really reflecting this sort of, like when she was young, that sort of selfish impatience that she had, and she wanted her writing to reflect that emotionally. And so she really made an effort to have those, that sort of different side of the voice of her own self come out in the different memoirs, which I found was fascinating.
I agree, Leslie. That is a really important part of her writing. I focused on Lorenzo in Taos about D.H. Lawrence with my husband and associate producer Robert Althaus, and we combed over those pages, and what it was so great about her writing about that is that she really was able to tell the story from front to end, and the little innuendos of just even like their hands accidentally touching in the dishwasher. You know, and they both kind of oopsie, you know, and you just, for one little gesture like that, she was able to describe the nature of their relationship being, you know, very much, there's a lot of chemistry there, but everybody's pulling away, and it was very tumultuous. And so her memoirs, I think, really reflect what almost anybody could do if they just take the time to be reflective and connect to their emotions and talk about their own lives.
Yeah.
We all go through these things that really define us over time, and she just was disciplined enough to do it. She was disciplined enough to write, as many painters and modernists were disciplined enough to get their paintings on canvases, so you can actually, through your art, create the movement, and that's what Mabel did.
And that was the thing that happened when she brought D.H. Lawrence out. She brought George O'Keeffe out. George O'Keeffe was instantly able to make paintings that expressed her emotions and her feelings about New Mexico. And Mabel was inspired by this. And so she took 10 years of her life and just wrote the memoirs. And the film is about a woman coming into her own and finding her own voice and realizing that if she wanted security or stability or to make a difference, she had to take responsibility for herself. And it's a great lesson for, I think, a lot of women today who are struggling to find their way.
The film is called Awakening in Taos, the Mabel Dodge Lujan Story. It opens this Wednesday, November 18th at 7 o'clock at the Lenzic Center for Performing Arts here in Santa Fe. It's the world premiere, but it's sold out, ladies and gentlemen, so don't even try to get tickets. There are also going to be other screenings in the future.
Will be December 5th at the Santa Fe Film Festival at the Jean Cocteau Theater. On the 5th at 4 p.m., so there'll be some other opportunities, and the Cocteau Theater wants to screen it a couple of times this winter.
Excellent. So there will be opportunities to see it. Have you made a cut that is like an hour long for public TV?
Well, the version that we're showing now is a theatrical version. It's over an hour and 5 minutes, And we have to cut it down to 56 minutes and 40 seconds precisely for PBS. And that's our next phase, is to finish up some of the technical things with it and then edit down our broadcast version of it, so that we'll have one for film festivals and theatrical screenings and art museums, and we'll have another one that gets broadcast on PBS and hopefully international broadcast.
Well, we look forward to seeing the trajectory of this film, and once again, many congratulations for having finished it. It's a long 10-year process for all of you. Mark Gordon is writer, director, and producer of the film. Leslie Harold Dillon is the voice of Mabel Dodge Lujan. Nancy Kenny is music composer and supervisor. She's also associate producer of the film. Lots of people worked on this, and it's a terrific job that you've all done. Thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks so much
for having us.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.